Orson Scott Card's Intergalactic Medicine Show presents Dogs from Other Places by Shannon Peavy. I can tell my dog's been to the other place. It's the stink on his fur, like cold rain on an aluminum gate. He's been gone for 2 days. I thought he'd been hit by a car. It might have been better if he had. I ruffle the black fur behind his ears and say, "Welcome back, Walter." He tilts his head and looks at me, and his tail doesn't wag. I drive a long stretch of Highway 530 every other day, headed to my part-time job. I'd been working full-time at this point last year, but there's less call for help these days, with everything else that's going on. It's still a pretty drive, a twisted ribbon of road crammed into the shoulders of the Cascades. This time of year, it's all yellow and brown leaves ghosting the trees, and piebald cows growing thin, and little boxy beehives. Mist in the morning, and rain in the afternoon. The radio plays Neil Young, and I turn it up loud, mumbling the words in a tuneless monotone, and carefully not thinking about how I left Walter sitting motionless in the kitchen, staring at his dog bowl and not touching a crumb. At the time, I'd thought, God, is it catching? Is it catching? But I don't think it now. Neil Young sings about how he's getting old, and I feel it too. Every year here weighing heavily on my spine. I drive past a pastel two-story that used to be an exotic palm nursery and now sells upholstery. The Oso Fire Department has a sign in an empty field thanking everyone for the success of their salmon bake, now months past. I'd gone, of course. Not attending big community events like that is just asking for uncomfortable questions. Then the fire department would be on your doorstep anyway, asking you how things were going. Was everything all right? While they sniffed you over for a hint of wet metal. I end up early to work. There are a couple cars in the church lot next door, but nobody waiting in our parking lot needing emergency milk for their coffee. That's happened before. Not like I'm going to judge what people think is important or anything. I open the register and spend an hour making pretty pyramids in the produce department before flipping the sign. Then I reorganize the cereals and check the expiration dates on all of the dairy. The only noises are the whir of the refrigeration units and the quiet sound of cars passing on the highway. The road's blocked off a few miles northeast, of course, before the borders of the other place. But a few people live near there, even still. After a while, Mrs. Greer comes by, and I help her find some bay leaves. She's a sweet lady. Maybe her marble bag's got a hole or two, but I like her okay. Her son Alex used to live near me. He cooked meth out of his house, and then one day, no warning at all, he just walked off. Went barefoot down the highway to the northeast, racked with full-body twitches and with the kind of look in his eyes that can't see anything other than what he's walking toward. He hasn't come back. "Thank you, dear," Mrs. Greer says, rattling her bottle of bay leaves so they crunch and click against the glass. "I never would have found these otherwise." The spices are alphabetized, but I don't say so. I just smile and say, "Have a nice day, ma'am." And that's all the business for the morning. I don't see another soul until lunch, when I'm eating a sandwich behind the counter and fumbling my ringing cell phone out of my purse. Of course, that's when I see someone drive into the lot and park their car. I'm chewing and answering the phone at the same time. "Hello? I've got a customer coming in. I've only got a second."
"Carrie?"
"Yeah, that's me," I say, and shove the rest of my sandwich under the counter. "Who's this?" A long silence. Telemarketer, I'm thinking, even though they wouldn't call me by my first name. I pull the phone from my ear and I'm going to punch out the call when I hear the answer, thin and tinny through cheap speakers.
It's Walter, the voice says. I need help.
I put the phone down on the desk, very calmly. The screen says the call is from home.
Carrie?
Says the voice. It sounds afraid. I end the call. The man from the parking lot pushes through the door and sets the bell jingling. I watch him wander over to the snack food section, and I don't take my hand off my phone. My fingers are shaking, but only a little. I don't go home, not then. It isn't like I can leave work early anyway. I'm the only one in the store until afternoon. I've had that job for a long time. There aren't many other employment opportunities in a dying little town like this one. By the time Sarah comes to take over the register, I've almost managed to convince myself it didn't happen. Until I check my phone and see a missed call from home, but it's better just not to check it. You look tense, Sarah says, raking her hair back into a ponytail. Rough day? I say, you know how it is, just rowdy shoppers nonstop all day. Sarah snorts, and we look around the empty store. I see I have a busy evening ahead of me, she says. I clock out and leave my apron folded under the counter. The stitching in the sea of Carrie is starting to come undone. The bell over the door jangles as I leave. It's still light out for another hour or two. The parking lot of the store is empty but for my little Corolla and Sarah's expedition. The lot outside the church is full. Might as well, I think. The pastor's saying something about purity of spirit and metal being tested in the fire when I slip in. I sit quietly in the back row. A couple people around me turn to look, but nobody says anything. On the back wall of the church, under the plain white cross and the red shield of the fire department, there's a new icon next to the others. A little woman doll made of thin rodent bones and wire and horsehair. Her head is a bird skull, its beak cracked in half. I don't know who she is, except for the obvious. She's a person who's walked off. She's gone, dead or other. No one's mentioned anyone gone, but of course it's not something people like to admit. They say it's nobody's fault, yet people tend to look askance at the families of walkers, like they could have done something to stop it. The pastor sets a little gift of water and blood in front of each icon. He tells us that it's to soothe their spirit, wherever they may have gone. Water to rust metal, and blood to remind them of what they once were. It's pig's blood, not human. But apparently it's much the same. That's what the pastor told me years ago, when I laid the first offering at my boyfriend's icon. I'd been nervous and clumsy and slopped some of the blood on my shoes. The pastor said, "It's just pig's blood." And later he said, "I'm sorry for your loss." When the service is over, I stand and shuffle out with the rest of the crowd. I look back once over my shoulder at the lines of icons. I can't tell which one is Mike's anymore. Not from this distance. Walter's waiting for me when I get back home. It's dim dark and I didn't leave the porch lights on, but I can see him shift behind the window, black and hulking. My key slips on the lock. I try again. Then I'm in and I grit my teeth and push past him like I normally would. His side brushes my leg, but he moves aside and follows neatly at my heels as we head into the kitchen. I dump my purse on the counter beside a pile of old mail and an empty yogurt container. "Hey, Walter," I say.
"Carrie," he says, "I called for you."
He sits up very straight when he talks, and his ears go back. He doesn't look like my dog anymore. His expression is too different, too intelligent. "Yeah," the walk-around phone's knocked off its cradle and lying face up on the floor. "How did you manage that anyway?"
"I had a lot of wrong numbers," Walter says. I nod, because I don't know what else to do.
So I nod and go to the fridge and pour myself some cheap wine. It's good just to hold the glass.
"I feel strange," Walter says.
"Yeah, me too," I say, and suck wine through my teeth. Walter's head drops. He whines, low in the back of his throat.
"I'm sorry."
"It's okay." We lapse into silence. The dog drops down to lie in a parentheses curve by the doorframe, a safe 10 feet from my chair. I prop my elbows on the kitchen table and watch him. I remember getting him as a puppy, a little black squirming thing. We played ball in the backyard. I could never get him to stop chasing rabbits. "Why did you go?" I say, finally. He lifts his head and his mouth drops open, and a little slip of tongue shows between his teeth.
"I don't know," he says. "I don't remember much about being a dog."
"What do you remember?" He pauses.
"I remember walking," he says, "down the road. And I remember crossing the barricades. And I remember being in the other place. And then I came back for you, because I'm your dog, and it wasn't right for me to be there, and you not to be."
"All right," I say. The wet metal stench of him lies thick in the air. He's probably been grinding it into the carpets and the couch all day while I was gone. If the fire department came by now, everything smells of strangeness. There's only one thing left I can think to ask. "Did you see anyone in the other place?"
"Yes," Walter says. "Not like you knew them."
I hadn't thought they would be the same. I push back from the table, leaving my wine half-finished and warm from the heat of my palms on the glass. "I'm going to bed." Walter says nothing. He puts his head down on his paws. I feel a little queasy afterward, a tight rolling in my stomach while I brush my teeth and wash my face. I stare into the toilet bowl for a few minutes, willing it to pass. But nothing comes up, and I still feel like I've swallowed battery acid. So I climb into bed with my jeans still on and my shoes on the rug beside me, ready to go in case I need to, in case something happens. And I shut the door. I know I did. Tested it carefully to make sure it was really latched. I stood there tugging on the knob and feeling like an idiot who was afraid of her own dog. But then, I wake in the night. Some sound wakes me, and I lie there very still, listening and trying to keep my breath sleep even.
"Everyone there is made of wire," Walter says,
his voice low and full of some terrible emotion.
"The animals are people. The people are just animals. People have always been animals.
I open my eyes a crack. In the sliver of dim light filtered by my lashes, I see him. My breath catches, and he must know I'm not asleep anymore. Walter's paws are up on the side of the bed, his great black head slanted toward me, open to allow the rush of air and speech. His teeth glint.
You go there because you're called, Walter says. There's something about you that's wrong, and there they will take it away. You will be purified in fire.
I squeeze my eyes shut and don't move. The acid roils in my stomach, almost enough to make me scream. In time, the bed dips and lifts, and Walter drops down to the floor. His nails click across the hardwood. The door creaks as he pushes it wider with his nose. I listen to him click, click down the hall, and then I listen for a while longer. But I don't hear anything else. Nothing but night noises and the flick of wind against the house's cracked siding, and the faint metal squeal of my bed springs, shifting under me as my weight shifts. I don't sleep. The next day is my day off. The day after that, I call in sick. And 2 days after that, too. A really bad cold, I tell Sarah. Wouldn't want to infect anyone. She laughs, but I can tell her patience is running out. She reminds me there's practically no one to infect, then wishes me a swift recovery and hangs up before I can say anything else. You're keeping me prisoner here. Walter yawns.
I'm not, he says. Leave when you want.
But he's lying a step from the door. I'd have to step over his back. I'd have to shove him aside in order to get the door open. Once I'd have done it without a thought. But not after that first night and seeing him there over my bed, saying the things he said. Sometimes I go out to the backyard, and he comes with me. I look at the gray October sky and the ramshackle remains of the house where Alex Greer cooked his meth. We always suspected, even before he walked away. Mike and I used to stand here in the yard and look at the roofline and make up shit that Alex might be doing. Smuggling state secrets or breeding weaponized dolphins or whatever. The real story was infinitely more boring. Mike walked away 6 months before Alex did. I didn't even see him go. Just one morning there was an empty place beside me, and the door hanging open, and Walter standing down at the end of the gravel drive just barking, barking. I pick up a dog toy but don't throw it. It's a little purple spiky ball that's scented like vanilla, I guess to freshen your dog's breath. Walter looks at it once, then looks away. He doesn't seem impressed. Mike's in the other place, I say. Walter says nothing. So instead I say, the day you called me, you said you needed help. Walter's silent again, so I'm thinking, sure, he needed help. Maybe help hanging up the phone without opposable thumbs. After a long time, Walter says,
was I a good dog?
It's not the question I was expecting. I pass the ball from hand to hand and try to smell vanilla over the overwhelming tang of metal.
Yeah, you were. Oh, he says.
I remember what he said before, and it makes me want to bury my hand in the ruff of fur at his neck and tell him that he's good, or at least he was once. There wasn't anything wrong with you, Walter. I don't know why you left, but there wasn't anything wrong with you. He laughs, low in his throat. It's an almost doggy noise, a low chuff like I've heard him make 100 times before. But his meaning is different.
And now?
I can't say. I can't say anything. So I don't. And his words linger in the air until he turns in place and starts toward the back door, his tail held low and still. Maybe I should make Walter a little fetish, a doll made of bone and hair and wire. Maybe if I knelt at it every day, gave it offerings of blood and water, he'd remember how to be a dog again. But maybe he doesn't want to remember. The firemen come after a week. I know it's them, even before I answer the door. The knock had that fireman heft, like you'd open the door and there'd be a guy straight from a pin-up calendar on your front step, gleaming white smile and coveralls half-buttoned over his bare chest. I'm standing out of sight in the kitchen, and I can see the edge of his navy coat.
"If you don't let him in, he'll break the door," says Walter.
"He'll smell you."
"If he tries anything, I'll tear his throat out."
So I creep over to the door and swing it open. The fireman, conventionally attractive and fully clothed, gives me an odd look before saying,
"Afternoon, ma'am."
The look's probably for my bathrobe and ratty socks. I cross my arms over my chest and say, "What can I do for you?" He smiles and shows every one of his white teeth. I hadn't known humans had that many gleaming teeth.
"Just in the neighborhood and thought I'd check in. No one's seen you in town recently."
"Just been sick." I smile back, and if it looks a little forced, the fireman makes no sign. "I'm sure no one's missing me, are they?"
"Mrs. Greer said she missed you in the store," he says. "Says nobody knows how to find things like you."
And then he catches it. The smell has saturated the house. He sniffs, and he catches a whiff of metal, and all of a sudden, all of the amicability is gone from his face.
"You had any strange visitors lately?"
"No," I say, straight-faced. "Nobody really visits anymore. I think the house next door scares them off. Those meth houses can blow at any time, right?"
"Nobody."
"It's just me and my dog."
"All right," the fireman says. "Sorry to disturb you, ma'am."
And for a second, I think that's it. He's going to turn and go. Maybe I'm just that convincing. But as I step back from the door to close it, the fireman throws his shoulder into the frame. I stand where I am. I try to slam the door, but he catches it in his hands, and I can't get it shut. He squeezes through the gap while I jolt back, looking around for something that could be a weapon.
"You've been to the other place," he says, grabbing me by the arm. "You've been there, haven't you?"
I scrabble backwards, searching for purchase, skidding helplessly in my socks. His fingers feel like they're going to punch right through my arm and down to the bone.
"I haven't,"
I say, my voice a high wheeze.
"Did your boyfriend take you there?"
He says it with a thin sneer, those teeth nearing my throat and his breath rushing hot over my face.
"Was it Mike? Did he come back for you?"
"Mike didn't come for me." His fingers loosen just for a moment, and I rip away from him, stumbling back through the hall on my heels. "Mike didn't come for me," my mind repeats. "Mike never came for me." And then Walter's flying at the fireman, silent but for the heave of his breath. He lunges, and his teeth close on the fireman's wrist, and they dig down deep. No matter how the fireman moves, no matter how he clubs Walter's nose with his other hand, the dog won't let go. And that's enough time for me to draw a knife from the kitchen block and advance on them. It's a pink ceramic knife from Target, but the edge is still very sharp. Get out of my house, I say, and my voice only shakes a little. The man swallows visibly. He's plaster pale except where his arm is slick with blood. Walter lets go long enough to growl, deep and threatening. The fireman stumbles back from him and grabs for the door. He says, "Just leave. Go. You don't belong here anymore." We stand on the step and watch him flee to his car. When he comes back, he won't be alone.
"He's right," Walter says. "We should go."
"Right." I nod and then can't seem to stop nodding. I wind my hands into the sleeves of my bathrobe and squeeze very tight. Of course we need to go. We just assaulted a fireman. There's no higher law in this town. "Let me get my keys." But Walter steps up to me and nudges my arm with his nose. It's cold and wet, just like it was when he was a real dog.
"You know we won't need keys."
The way he says it, calm and chiding, just takes the breath out of me. I sag to the step and perch on my heels. I've dropped the knife, but I don't know where. I don't remember putting it down. "We don't need to go there," I say. "We can go south. Anywhere. We can start over." He says,
"Would it be any different?"
I don't know. All I know how to do is stack fruit. Walter presses his shoulder against mine, and his bulk is warm and comforting.
"You'll change if you go there," he says. "Everything changes."
I just want things to be the way they were. When the town was still thriving, and Mike and I talked about what we would name our children. But I know you can never go back. We walk, and I look at everything around me and wonder if it's for the last time. We're walking northeast on 530 past dairy cows and rusting trucks and low, flooded pastures. My socks have worn away at the heel, and my bathrobe is no shield against the cold air. A car whips past us at 55 and doesn't slow. People look at us as we go, but they don't stop us. You don't stop a person on their way to the other place. Once they've made up their mind to go, they're already lost. We arrive at the little bend with my store and the church after dark. They're locked up and empty, with no cars in the lot. It's not hard to break the lock on the church door. It's not hard to find the place where they hide the holy water and the little vials of pig's blood and tuck some away into the pockets of my robe. "I won't lose myself there," I tell Walter. "I'm going to get Mike, and we're going to find a way out of that place."
"You won't want to," Walter says.
We walk on, northeast, past the last of the human houses. The vials slosh in my pockets, and sometimes I put my hand over them just to make sure they're still there. Other times I think about my little part-time job at the store, about my empty house, about Walter's dark head above me saying,
"There's something about you that's wrong, and there they take it away."
I will change that place, but I won't let it change me. Like he's heard me, Walter looks up. His nails click, clicking on the pavement.
"Humans are meant to change," he says.